أشهد أن لا إله إلا الله أشهد أن محمد رسول الله أشهد أن محمد رسول الله
السلام عليكم Christianity. Welcome to another episode of Islam in Focus. I'm your host, Hamid Rashid. Today we have our 18th program in our series dealing with the sources of Islam. We'll be talking about the Quran and the modern Quran and modern science. I have joining me on the program, as usual, Dr. Jamal Badawi of St. Mary's University. Brother Jamal, assalamu alaikum. This has been such an interesting series, it's hard to believe that we've had 18 programs. It's gone so fast.
We still have a few more.
Before we get into today's program, could I have you very quickly highlight the main points that we touched on in our last program dealing with the Quran and modern science?
Okay. The major issue that was discussed in the previous program was the concept of the water cycle. And we indicated how the Quran made reference to that more than 900 years before modern science discovered it, which of course relates to the main question in the series as to what actually is the source of the Quran, who is the author, quote-unquote, of the Quran. Some of the specific detailed description that are found in the Quran deal with issues like the source of the spring water, that it comes actually from rainwater, unlike the previous myth that were known about it. The role of the wind in joining together clouds and as such increasing condensation, and the reference in the Quran that the wind act as impregnating or impregnating factors, that is getting non-rain carrying clouds with rain carrying clouds, and that eventually results in this condensation and fall of rain. And the third main issue, which was, I believe, quite amazing, really, is the mention in the Quran about the partition, quote-unquote, or the barrier between different masses of water, or seas, as the common term used, which is a reference also to the balance between salt water and fresh water. We discussed briefly also that even when we talk about the same type of waters, when we analyze the Gulf Stream, and the lengthy trip that it makes is still quite distinct from the rest of the water, with quite a considerable degree a difference in the degree of the water's temperature. That's something, again, that the Quran seemed to have made a much, much earlier reference before even we had any notion of this amazing phenomenon.
Mm-hmm. Now, I'd like to examine another aspect of the earth, that is the mountains. Is there any hint in the Quran about their function as the mountains?
Well, not only hint, in fact, there is very clear and explicit reference in the Quran about the very crucial function that the mountains play, particularly in stabilizing the crust of the earth. I'll just start with that citation first and just get some commentary from the standpoint of modern geology. The citation in the Quran, وَأَلْقَى فِي الْأَرْضِ رَوَاسِيَ أَنْ تَمِيدَ بِكُمْ, which means that Allah has cast into the ground mountains standing firm so that they do not shake with you. That is found, for example, in 31:10 and also in 16:15, 21:31. The thing that is interesting in that is the mention of the mountain as something that keeps the earth stable. In other citation in the Quran, it adds even another dimension of that description of the role of mountains. For example, in 78, Surah 78, particularly in 6 and 7, it describes the mountain as awtad, which means pegs or stakes, you know, just like the stakes or pegs holding the tent, a stable. And this is an interesting description that early in the Quran. Because now with new knowledge in modern geology, it was found that the radius of the Earth is perhaps a little less than 4,000 miles. Some estimate at about 3,700 or so miles. That is from the surface to the core of the Earth. And they found further that the crust, which is cool, on which we live and grow plants and all that, is really a very, very minor part of that radius. Approximately maybe 1%.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes they measure it as ranging anywhere between, let's say, 10 to 30 miles or so deep. Of course, in consideration of the total radius, it's really a very small part, just a crust, really. And it was found also by geologists that the folds on Earth which form the mountain or mountain ranges are very essential, because it gives this very thin crust a sort of stability. This is the process that some geologists also refer to as orogenesis, which means that in order for the development of the relief on Earth, the crust of Earth was driven proportionately far down. And that kind of process of pressure, in fact, ensures a sort of foundation in the layer which underlies the mountains. You see the accuracy of the description I would add, or the like pegs really holding. Some also refer to the balance between the depth, for example, of the ocean and the heights of the mountain, but all of these phenomena together seem to maintain the crust of the Earth in some degree of stability. Of course, this information definitely was not known at all at the time of the revelation of the Quran, nor even for hundreds of years afterwards.
Fascinating, our discussion last week with the discussion of the water cycle and this discussion of the mountains and so on. Before we move on, Ashtashki, are there any other natural phenomena which the Quran refers to that we should perhaps take a look at before we begin some discussion of life on Earth?
Well, there are numerous. Let me just give an example of two others that some writers seem to refer to frequently. Is the notion of the shadow. Of course, you might say, well, so what about the shadow? But again, let me first start with the citation in the Quran and just make a commentary on it. أَلَمْ تَرَ إِلَىٰ رَبِّكَ كَيْفَ مَدَّ الظِّلَّ وَلَوْ شَاءَ لَجَعَلَهُ سَاكِنًا. That's in Surah 25, particularly verses or passages 45 and 6. It says, has you not seen how your Lord spread, the term here, spread the shadow? If he willed, he would have made it stationary. Moreover, he made the sun its guide. As scientists try to interpret or understand from that citation, the question of extending the shadow, they say it is actually an evidence of the rotation of the Earth around its own axis in that interface of the sun. Because without this rotation, half of the Earth would be in perpetual day, and the other half would be perpetual night. And you might say, so what? Well, it could be devastating.
Yes, really.
Because life would perish on Earth eventually, because one part would be overexposed, the other part would be, you know, underexposed. So there's a difficulty here of growth of vegetation and so on. I mean, there is really some delicate balance here that related to this sort of rotation. And if it were true, as many people believed in the past, that the Earth is stationary, it would have meant that the shadow also would have remained stationary. And that's why the verse specifically says, if Allah willed, he would have made it stationary. But he didn't. He made it mobile, changing. This can be appreciated more if we refer back to the notion understood about the shadow at the time of the revelation of the Quran, or even afterwards, that they believed, or used to believe, that the sun moved from the east to the west, but the Earth was stationary. So the movement in the shadow actually was connected with this movement of the sun, not the movement of the Earth itself. In fact, the Quran makes another reference in Surah 28, reminding us again that what would you have done if Allah made the night perpetual or the day perpetual, which could be a reference to that phenomena. It could be a reminder to us also that there are some other parts of the world which definitely was not known to Prophet Muhammad at this time, like Scandinavia, where actually Allah shows us His signs by certain times of the year where it is, you know, perpetual day or night, mm-hmm. but of course not for the whole year, at least a certain portion of the year, mm-hmm. so there's a chance still of maintaining life. A second example also is found in respect of, to the study of oceanography, or what happens also within the in the deep oceans. And what scientists are telling us is that the sea storms or deep sea storms in fact result in the generation of different types of waves, which vary in width, length, and height, which actually can be described more or less as a sort of layers of waves. And again, this is something which was not known, of course, in the 7th century. And interesting enough, in Surah 24 in the Quran, there is reference specifically to this sort of layers.
Mm-hmm.
The, let's say, free translation of the citation says that the deeds of those who are unbelievers are like a mirage. And then it continues, or like darkness in a very deep ocean in which there are layers upon layers mm-hmm. Of waves. That is leading to total darkness, and then the verse says that if a person even looks at his hand, he will not be able to see it. And this is a reference again to a natural phenomena that exists there, not only the layers of the waves, but also the kind of cloudy setting that it generates to the point of having total darkness, in fact.
Mm-hmm. Well, perhaps now we can begin with a look at the life on Earth. I'd like to ask you if the Quran has anything to say about vegetation that was not known at the time of the revelation of the Quran.
Certain aspect of the vegetable kingdom.
Yes.
Well, there are numerous citations or passages in the Quran that deal with the question of vegetation, some of which are more general, more or less speaking about vegetation as a bounty from Allah or a gift to humankind. And that's found in numerous citations, for example, in 699.13.4, in 16.10.11, in 59.11. Some passages in the Quran refer to an interesting phenomenon again, which is the variations in the colors and tastes of fruits, even though, or vegetation, even though they are planted or watered with the same water, which could be an interesting hint also about the genetic code in the various plants, where the roots are actually picking the certain nutrients which are needed for that particular plant.
Mm-hmm.
It's an interesting phenomenon too. But one might say, right, in many of these citations, they may not seem to be anything that's particularly striking. However, the expressions mentioned about this vegetation is totally free of the common myth that existed about vegetation at the time of the revelation of the Quran, or even after, which shows again that the Quran was not simply a human document which is adapting or rehearsing what is known its time as other humanly written books, if you will. But in addition to this, there are also certain aspects that really require some further examination. Many of the scientists, for example, and ecologists, speak about the balance in nature, particularly the balance also in the vegetable kingdom. And the Quran makes several references to this due proportion or balance in the creation of Allah. It speaks about it in general, that is the due balance in the universe in general, such as in 9, 13, 25, 12, 54, 49, just talk in general. But there is one particular passage in the Quran, that is in 15:19, which is really interesting, because it speaks specifically about the ecological balance, if you will,
mm-hmm.
in the vegetation kingdom, saying that Allah caused all kinds of things to grow therein, that is on earth, and that is the word here, in due balance,
mm-hmm.
in due balance. The other aspect that the Quran refers to is the process of reproduction in plants. And as you realize that it was only relatively recently or in recent decades that the scientists found out that any plant really involves both the male and female type of in parts.
Mm-hmm.
And even some of the animals that were not regarded or seen as you know, different or regarded as unisex still was proven to have both male and female type of functions. And here again we find the Quran refers to this law of pureness on two levels, generally and with respect to vegetation.
Mm-hmm.
Generally speaking, the Quran says in 51:49 that of everything did Allah create things in pairs. And it says there is things, which means animals, vegetations, humans, and things even. Even if you look at the atom, you talk about electrons and neutrons, so there's always electricity. There is the positive and negative. But beyond that general statement, we find more specifically in 20:53 in the Quran, it speaks again about the variations of plants in pairs, referring again to this application of the law of pureness as it applies to plants. A third aspect also, if you may add that too, the process of germination. So when you put the plants or the seed in the soil, it goes through certain stages. And scientists tell us that the first thing that happens that the outside casing of the seed breaks up or splits. Actually, the word split is an accurate expression. And that allows the roots to emerge and draw the nutrients from the soil and result, of course, in the growth mm-hmm. of a new plant. Interesting enough, one passage in the Quran, in 9, that's Surah 9, in Ayah 95, it says, إِنَّ اللَّهَ فَالِقُ الْحَبِّ وَالنَّوَى. Verily, Allah splits the grain and footstone. Again, the question here is the sober language used in the Quran that is very descriptive mm-hmm. of what scientists have been able to observe and study splitting
mm-hmm.
the grains.
Well, the animal life is a little more complex process.
Mm-hmm.
How about animal life on Earth? How does the Quran explain it?
Perhaps maybe we can begin with, again, broad statements as we did in the question of plants, that there is definitely a number of passages in the Quran which speaks again of animals, of the creation of animals and cattle as a bounty of Allah. Those who might be interested in that can review, for example, in Surah 16, in the beginning of Surah 16, there is mention of the cattle that Allah has created and how we derive warmth from them, that's through clothing and the tents or using their hides for some variety of purposes, the food that it provides, the milk, the carrying our loads, and all the remaining, enjoying even the beauty of watching those animals like horses and others. That's one aspect. However, some interesting things also pertaining to the animal kingdom pertain to the process of reproduction. And perhaps that can be dealt with when we deal with the human reproduction, because that's even a more fascinating and interesting subject in which the Quran gives lots of explanations.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the things that is really very fascinating, which is basic to the animal kingdom, is the notion that animals also, like humans, live in communities. Just like communities with social organizations and leadership and everything else that we humans think is exclusive to us.
Well, the last point is a very interesting point. I think perhaps there's room for some clarification on it. Is it my understanding that the notion of animals living in kingdoms was not fully understood until recently?
Yes, and that's again the whole question here is where did the Quran get this information from?
Mm-hmm.
If the
mm-hmm.
Quran was copying from state of knowledge at the time of the Prophet,
mm-hmm.
you're absolutely right. Yes, it's a very relatively recent type of phenomena, and it was achieved only after systematic and detailed observation and study of animal behavior was possible. And there is an interesting area in the Quran, particularly with this notion of community, or communal life of animals. In 6:38, وَمَا مِن دَابَّةٍ فِي الْأَرْضِ وَلَا طَائِرٍ يَطِيرُ بِجَنَاحَيْهِ إِلَّا أُمَمٌ أَمْثَالُكُمْ. Which means that there is no animal on earth And the original word, actually, Dabba means anything that walks or moves on earth, living. There is no animal on earth, nor bird, which flies on two wings or on wings, that does not belong to communities like you, that is like you or humans. And the attempts are being made quite earnestly, in fact, to study that further and try and understand what is that mechanism which is at the heart of this community living, if you will, of the various types of animals. It's a fascinating field by itself.
Mm-hmm. Are there specific examples of the organizations you speak of in the animal kingdom?
The community type of living. One of the most interesting things in the Quran is that it refers many times to various creations of Allah, to the point that even some surahs in the Quran are titled after some specific animal or even insect. For example, you find the surah in the Quran called the bees, al-nahl. Another spider, another an-naml, which means the ant. But perhaps one of the interesting things that the Quran refers to, which has been subjected to a great deal of scientific study in recent decades, is the community living of the bee, the honey bee. There is an amazing citation about that in the Quran, which appears actually in Surah 16, which, by the way, takes its name. It's called An-Nahl also, the bees.
Mm-hmm.
In passages 68 and 69, it speaks about how Allah inspired the bees to make habitation or to build its own habitations or homes in the mountains, on the top of the trees or rooftops, and that it says Allah inspired them to eat from all types of fruits. And then it says, then follow the ways of your Lord. Follow the ways of your Lord. And then it speaks about the honey that comes out of their belly and how it, in that honey there is cure for people. Now, there are a number of interesting points here that this citation refers to. First of all, why does it speak particularly about the bees? Is there anything special about the community life of the bees? And even though it starts addressing bees in plural, when it says make out of mountains habitations for yourself, it says ittakhidhi, which is a female gender. And that raises question. Is that a possible hint of the fact that the main builders of this bee habitation are in fact the female workers? Why the Quran specified the female genders in building the cells? The other thing which is really interesting also, it says follow the way of your lords, that is in taking the fruits or sucking this juice from the flowers and so on, and its transformation into honey. Follow the ways of your Lord. And what scientists have found is that there is a remarkable nervous organization in the bee in particular, which actually is reflected in the pattern of the so-called bee dance. There have been very in-depth studies of the bee dance. And when a bee, for example, discovers a place where there are flowers, she comes back and informs other bees as to how to get there. If I were to put it in some easy-to-follow form, in some colloquial way even, it would sound like this. A bee coming to the other group of bees and say, hey, you guys, I discovered some awful nice flowers down there. Let me tell you how you get there. You go straight for 20 feet, then turn right, take a 90-degree, move, and keep going there for 30 feet, and then move to the north at 45 degrees and go for another 50 feet and you'll find lots of nice flowers. Go and help yourselves. Well, you might find that you might think that this is simply a sort of humorous way of putting it, but scientifically speaking, that's basically what happens. The study of the pattern of that so-called bee dance, the way she moves the wings and the direction and so on, gives this exact information. This has been followed time after time. It was found to exactly give the same kind of directions, or the symbols have been already deciphered. So there is a definite communication and definite direction. One of those who made lots of studies on that is a man by the name of Von Fritsch. It's Von, V-O-N, Fritsch, F-R-I-S-C-H. In addition to this, some studies were made also on how the cells or the hives are designed. And again, it was found that there is a meticulous certain angles and degrees. There is a definite manual that the bees have in their own genetic code, if you will. A very meticulous way of designing. The question of mentioning of the cure in honey for many diseases is again a matter that is a topic by itself, and there have been people who have made lots of studies about the benefit, health benefit of the honey. Another example, if I may, is similar to that also in terms of the nervous cell type of programming, if you will, that God has taught the various creatures, is the spiders. In Surah 29, for example, while the citation here, particular verse 41, so passage 41, appears to be just the spiritual, there is a great deal of mention there, or reference to scientific things. For example, if you translate it literally, it would say something like this: those who choose masters and supporters other than Allah are like the spider when it takes for itself a dwelling. And then it says, verily, the flimsiest dwelling is the dwelling of the spider if they know. Now, there are two things here to be observed. One is that, like the bee, again, it was found that the nervous system of the spider is programmed in such a way that it really results in the creation of perfectly geometric type of design. That's the kind of web they do. Mm-hmm. The additional discovery as to why the Quran chose, among all other things, the spiders to refer to as the flimsiest and weakest of dwellings, is that it was found also that there are certain glands in the spider which secrete this very, very fine threads with which the spider makes the web. And it was found that the caliber of those fibers is almost infinitely fine, that it is perhaps the weakest or the most fine type of dwelling, that it's virtually unimitatable. You cannot synthetically, for example, mm-hmm. imitate this silken type of of threads.
Mm-hmm. Well, in the very few moments that we have left on the program today, you mentioned that one of the surahs of the Quran is titled The Ants. Is there anything unusual about the ants which this surah mentions?
Yes, there is. In fact, as you said, the one surah actually is called The Ants, and halfway, or sometimes in the surah, particularly from passages 17 to 19, and the surah number is 27, it speaks actually about the story of Prophet Solomon. And it says how Prophet Solomon, on his way once, he had a big army which included human beings, it included birds and so on. And then it says, and that's the interesting part about it, it says one ant told the other ants, get back into your dwelling, lest Solomon and his army crush you under their feet without realizing what they're doing. Well, on the surface, some people might say, well, an ant telling all this sophisticated message, for many people, it would have sounded very strange and very difficult to grasp. But there have been lots of studies that were made on ants and how they have this meticulous social organization among themselves. It was found that not only do they have this organization, they have also a great deal of intelligence. They love to work and work hard. And beside humans, ants are the only animals known to us that bury its dead, which is something really fascinating. It was found that ants also developed the custom of meeting in large groups once in a while, almost like a marketplace, exchanging commodities, get to know each other, or chat, as we call it even among humans. They do collective projects together, like building or construction of roads. And of course, you know, if you construct roads, you have to have lots of organization and how to channel the effort of everybody. Furthermore, when they collect their food, If it's too big and they cannot get it in their storehouse, if you will, they try to split it. If it's too heavy, they keep pushing it with their legs and then raise it with their arms because they can't carry it in their mouths. But something even more fascinating is that when the rain falls and the greens they collected get wet, they take it out to dry in the sun and wind and then open air and then take it back. One amazing thing again that shows how all of these things are programmed by the Creator is that when they collect the greens, they start cutting the roots and then they split it. You see the reason? Because once you split the grain, cut the roots, there's no chance that it would grow in a form of a plant, and as such it maintains its storage of the food. So if this sophisticated things are going on among ants, then what's so strange about communicating a specific message with a specific meaning?
Mm-hmm. Fascinating. We have to stop at that point, though, because our time is gone. We want to thank you for watching and invite you back next week. Assalamu alaikum. Peace be unto you.